So, your question, yes.
So, what are the goals of the TWSTRR program nowadays? Is it to understand Einstein's classical theory better? Is it to provide a quantum theory of relativity? Is it to provide a unified theory of all forces? How do we think about it?
Yes. Well, now you've asked that question, because that's in direct conflict with what the special requests from the experts were, that I shouldn't waste any time on preliminaries and should go straight into the new stuff.
No, but that's
yes.
Not a preliminary.
No. It's a question. Now I have to... Yes. Yes. Well, I should explain the idea behind TWSTRR theory, which is the same as it always was, it hasn't changed, is to try to find some appropriate union between Einstein's general relativity and quantum theory. But it's somewhat kind of backhanded or through the back door sort of approach, because as you would have heard from my lecture, particularly on a couple of days ago, my view is that quantum theory will also have to bend, that one's looking for a union which is more even-handed between the two, and not simply imposing quantum theory as it stands now on general relativity. So the idea is to look for things which might link the two subjects rather than directly try to quantize space-time structure. And so it sort of proceeds in a kind of not very direct way. But I would say the basic motivation is from complex structure, because quantum mechanics is fundamentally based on the complex number field, and one is looking for features of general relativity which also seem to reflect complex number structure, and just trying to make connections between these things. So it's not kind of a directed program in the same sense that most quantum gravity programs are, but its goals are basically the same thing, to try and find a union between these subjects, but in a way which allows maybe not to take quantum theory exactly as it is, but to look for features in quantum theory which might persist and other features which you might expect to change, most particularly looking for things which are manifold structures rather than vector space structures, because quantum theory has this linear background, and one is maybe looking for things which are complex manifolds rather than necessarily linear spaces. But that's sort of very vague, but in response to your question.
Is it non-computable?
Well, that I should say that not only is it not obviously non-computable, it's not obviously non-quantum mechanics in the sense of incorporating state reduction. So that it's a long way from any of those goals. And the thing I want to talk about today is much more how it fits in with general relativity, recent ideas for making Einstein's vacuum equations, not even matter at the moment, vacuum equations fit in with the TWSTRR program, and recent advances over the past, well, couple of years have certainly changed one's perspective on this problem somewhat. I suppose I was going to make a concession to those who are not experts by just saying something about the motivation, even though my colleagues who requested me not to do this will be upset by this, but I won't take very long of it. I'll just take a few minutes. Thank you. Here one has space-time. Light rays are to be regarded as the first approximation is points in TWSTRR space, and the light rays through a point represent a point in space-time, would be a sphere, and my space-time, I should say, is four-dimensional, three space and one time, so the light cone, the directions along the light cone form a two-sphere, and this two-sphere naturally has a conformal structure, and I'm identifying that with a Riemann sphere, so it's a complex one-dimensional manifold, and reflecting the fact that the Lorentz group, or the non-reflective Lorentz group, is isomorphic with the group of holomorphic transformations of the simplest complex manifold, namely the sphere, the Riemann sphere. And specifically, one makes the correspondence. The key relationship in this correspondence is what we call incidence. Here we have space-time points in Minkowski space. This is just flat space for the moment. These R's arranged in that Hermitian matrix.
The room is small.
Oh, yes. Okay, well, I'll do it here, yes. That may get in the way somewhat. This Hermitian matrix represents the space-time coordinates, and we have four complex parameters being the components of the TWSTRR, incidence means this matrix relation holds. For this thing to be a Hermitian matrix, in other words, this to be a real point, one requires the equation here, that's very easy to see from here, which is the equation of this space here. I should say that these four coordinates are projective coordinates, that is, it's the ratios of these you're interested in, which give you the points in this projective three-dimensional space, which is what's called projective twister space, complex projective free space. And points in this space which lie on this subspace here, given by that equation, represent light rays, possibly at infinity. Points over here represent these complex projective lines over here, which are the Riemann spheres I was talking about at the top there. And because a complex projective line is topologically a sphere. And that's basically the correspondence. The incidence relation tells you that this point lies on that line, or this point lies on this line, and by holding either the blue things fixed and letting the orange ones vary, in which case you get the line here, or holding the orange ones fixed and let the blue things vary, in which case you get the light ray over here, which is that relationship. So that's basic. That's the basic twister theory correspondence in a nutshell. I want to rewrite the incidence equation in terms of two spinners. That is, the twister formalism is expressed in terms of two component spinners very neatly. So I have to assume that people are familiar with the notation to some degree. These are two dimensional indices, the prime ones, complex conjugates of the others. This R represents the Hermitian matrix I had before, and that's the incidence relationship. So if you hold the blue ones fixed, you get the space-time representation of a twister, which I'll come to in a second. If you do it the other way around, you get the twister representation of a point. These two pairs of components of the twister, omega and pi, are the two spinner parts of the twister. They play rather different roles, as I'll indicate in a moment. The equation I had a moment ago, which was this thing at the bottom of the previous transparency, finds its form z bar equals naught, where z bar is the complex conjugate of that. And remember, when you take complex conjugates, the primed and unprimed indices interchange, and so I'm interchanging the two of them also in my representation, so that this thing is a dual thing to that, that's a dual thing to that, and this represents just omega pi bar plus pi omega bar. The things with lower indices, it's noticed that the complex conjugate has a downstairs index, therefore a dual object to the original twister, and its representation therefore in the projective three space is as a plane. So if a twister in twister space, projective twister space, is represented as a point, a dual twister is represented as a plane. And the condition for this thing to vanish is that that point lies on the plane. It's quite usual to talk about complexified space-time. That allows this R to be complex, in which case the incidence doesn't give you, as it did before, just a light ray. See, here I'm fixing the twister when it's on the space Pn, and letting the points incident with it vary, and you get the light ray in space-time. If we go to the complex space, then you don't necessarily need the condition of what I call null twister relationship. That one, you don't need that. And the representation of a twister is, that is to say, you hold the twister fixed and let the complex points vary, is what we call an alpha plane. An alpha plane in complex Minkowski space is a totally null plane. Totally null means that the metric vanishes completely on it. Any two tangent vectors are orthogonal to each other, including orthogonal to themselves and so on. Vanish just disappears. The metric just disappears. It's what we call an alpha plane. If you did this corresponding thing for a dual twister, you get a beta plane. These are the two kinds of planes in complex Minkowski space, which are completely null. They're either self-dual or anti-self-dual. The alpha planes are the self-dual ones, if I have them the right way around, and the beta planes are the anti-self-dual ones. The alpha planes represent up to proportionality twisters. The beta planes represent up to proportionality dual twisters. Okay, so that was a very rapid description of basic twister theory. The relationship to physics, well, that's just what happens when you shift an origin. I should just mention that. The pi's are independent of origin, whereas the omegas change as you move the origin by this expression here. So the omegas are, well, pi's are, in fact, that's the physical description of these things, says in a certain sense that the pi's are momentum-like things and the omegas are angular momentum-like things. More precisely, you relate the twister, pi, and omega to momentum and angular momentum through these formulae here. If you take the spinner pi multiplied by its complex conjugate, you get something, I should say, when you have two indices, one primed and one unprimed, collect them together and you form a tensor index. So this is a four momentum, and the fact that it splits as a product means it's null. It also, because this is complex conjugate times something, it is a future pointing null vector. So the fact that P is a future pointing null vector is incorporated in that formula there, and what I'm trying to represent is the momentum and angular momentum of a massless particle in terms of twisters, these two conditions here being requirement for a massless particle. The angular momentum is this expression here in terms of the twister parts, the round brackets meaning symmetrization. Here we have omega times pi bar times the epsilon, this is the Levi-Civita symbol, symmetrical, and you add this to its complex conjugate with an I in there, so you subtract these two parts here. This automatically gives you the relationship, well, first of all, it's skew-symmetric automatically in the pair AA prime BB prime. You interchange the two pairs, you get minus what you had before, that just follows from this expression. So that the M you get from here in tensor form is skew-symmetrical. Moreover, if you construct the Pauli-Lubansky spin vector from it, you take the P and the M and dualize. This object S is the Pauli-Lubansky spin vector. For a self-respecting massless particle, it should be proportional to the momentum, S being the helicity, the factor of proportionality, which is a real number which could be positive, negative, or zero in this classical scheme here. It turns out, if you work it out, that this is actually the norm of the twister that I had before with a factor of half. So that this quantity here represents the helicity. So that's the sort of physical interpretation of the parts of the twister. You see that pi is a momentum thing, and the omega together with pi has this angular momentum structure, and as you shift the origin, as I've indicated there, you find that the origin does in fact, the angular momentum transforms as it should under origin shift. Moreover, we have this quantization procedure, or if you might call it first quantization, the commutation rules for momentum and angular momentum, as you know, are a little bit complicated, but if you look at the commutation rules for twisters that naturally arise, you find that the Z's are canonical conjugates of their complex conjugates. So you have the canonical commutation relations here. There's no I in this because this is a complex conjugate and that's the right way around. And you find, working it through, that with these commutation rules, the P and M indeed satisfy the correct commutation rules for momentum and angular momentum. There is no factor ordering problem just because of the forms of these expressions. You do find that if you work out S, that now it has to be polarized in that way there. That just comes out from the formula that you have up here. That's all pretty well forced. Now, if you want to look at a quantum picture of a particle in a twisted description, it's going to be a massless particle because the massless relationship is automatic in this twister scheme here. You can take the Z representation, twister representation if you like, or the Z bar one. You can do whichever you choose. Let's take the Z representation. Then the wave function of a particle represented in terms of twisters would be a holomorphic function. because, as with ordinary quantum mechanics, you want to say you take one or other of these variables, you take the function of one of them, and the other one becomes differentiation with respect to that one. So your wave function is supposed to be just a function of one, not of both. That means it's a function of z, not of z bar. So therefore you have this relation, which is simply telling you that f is a holomorphic function, complex analytic function. So then you also have z bar represents this derivative with respect to z, with respect to z, this formula here. And the helicity then, as an operator, becomes h cross over 2 times minus the homogeneity operator here, minus 2. It's slightly shifted because of the symmetrization that you have here, but it's basically just zz bar, which is the Euler homogeneity operator. So what that means is that any function of a twister, which is an eigenstate, gives you an eigenstate of helicity, must be a homogeneous function, homogeneous and holomorphic function. And then we have, I'm always trying to finish this sort of introductory stuff, then we have where you get the fields from the twister function. Here's your twister function with the appropriate homogeneity degree, and you find that you can write down contour integral expressions to give you all the different massless fields, which I'll give you on another sheet here. I've written these all in two-spinner notation. In general, one has n indices symmetrical, satisfying this field equation. This is just the field, not potentials I'm talking about here. So this is zero, it's just the wave equation. And these ones would be the, if you're looking for positive frequency things, these things are negative helicity, these ones are positive helicity. So you have the different helicities represented by these equations here. And just to spell out what you have, oh yes, now I just should say that the relationship between the homogeneity degree and the helicity is given by the formula at the bottom here, and if I just apply that in various different cases, you can see what you get. The scalar wave, you have helicity 0, the twister function has homogeneity degree minus 2. If you take the Dirac-Weil equation for the neutrino, massless neutrino, you have the neutrino with minus a half helicity, minus 1 homogeneity degree function, and minus 3 if it's the antineutrino. For the Maxwell photon left-handed, you get 0 homogeneity for the left-handed one and minus 4 for the right-handed one. And the linearized Einstein graviton, talking about a massless field of spin 2, one has minus 2 for the left-handed helicity, and therefore plus 2 for the homogeneity degree, and minus 6 for the right-handed one. Notice this is extraordinarily lopsided. One has a complete chirality in this description. The right-handed and left-handed things are described by functions which really look quite different. So that it is a very chiral description. Of course, I could start all over again and use the dual twisters instead of the twisters, and then these things will be reversed. But you have to make up your mind and just use one or the other. Particularly, for example, if you wanted to describe a photon which was plane polarized, you'd need to have both the left and the right-handed parts, and you'd need, therefore, to... you shouldn't sort of switch over and say you use twister function for one and a dual twister one function for the other. That wouldn't make any sense. You couldn't even add them. So you've got to make a choice, one or the other. And that choice, well, maybe nature prefers one to the other, but we don't know that at the moment. For the moment, you just make a random choice, and I tend to choose the twisters rather than the dual twisters just because it saves a word or two. Now, okay. Going back to the twister function, the twister the contour integral expression, well, you put, in order to write down your contour integral, you've got to balance the homogeneity degree of this function. It's minus 2s minus 2, where s is the helicity, if I remember right. And you've got a 2 homogeneity degree from the natural differential form that sits over here. And then you have to balance the rest by putting a lot of pi's there, or else a lot of d by d omegas there. Remember that in the quantization procedure, the complex conjugate of pi goes to d by d omega. You can never use the complex conjugates because that's not a holomorphic thing. You have to keep everything complex analytic. That's part of the philosophy. So you could either put pi's in, that's complex analytic, or you can put d by d omega's in, that's also complex analytic, but you shouldn't put bars. These contour-integral expressions, to understand what's really going on, what you want to do is fix a point in space-time, and that means in the integral here you're looking at twisters which are incident with that point. That's the incidence relation, remember, I started with. So you're letting the twisters vary, the omegas and pi's vary, keeping the r fixed, but this really means you represent the omega, you rewrite the omega in terms of r and pi in the integral, and you integrate out the pi dependence, and then you get a function of r. Now, in more detail, what you do is you'd have some function here, which is holomorphic in some region. It's going to have singularity somewhere. It's holomorphic in some region. The point in space-time is represented, remember, by a Riemann sphere. I've drawn this as a sort of sausage here, so you can think of it as both a line and as a sphere, which it is both, of course. This is the Riemann sphere here. This is this thing. It intersects the region of definition of the function in some region which, if you choose things right, will be an annular region on the sphere, and your contour integral just goes around the annular region, and you find your field, and lo and behold, having done that, you find all these massless field equations are automatic consequences of the twister expressions, the homogeneity degree, and so on. So it gives you a way of generating solutions to those field equations automatically. Not now, because I'm talking about flat space. So in flat space, there is nothing to rule out about higher spin. But that will be an issue which comes up when we talk about curved space, absolutely. And of course, if you have interactions, you start worrying about that too.
Yeah, but
I think so. I mean, there's an issue there which I haven't... One really needs to understand the curved space stuff properly before getting to that. Because what happens is that twister space gets curved, and you can't write these expressions just straight down like that. You've got to think about what they mean. And that issue comes in. But yes, you're right. I mean, that's obviously a...
That's just what you want to do on a curved space.
On a curved space, yes.
On flat space.
Sure, on flat space there's nothing wrong with these equations for all spins. They're just a general procedure. Well, there are twister formalisms in other dimensions and in other signatures. They're not so neat. But you can certainly write down versions of contour integrals. Yeah. And these have been done.
You don't have the same complex structure.
The complex structures aren't so natural. You can complexify everything if you like and just talk about the complex. But you don't have in any other dimension the sort of initial motivation, which is the Riemann sphere, as being the light cone, you know, the directions along the light cone. So here is the only case where you have, I think it's the only case you get a complex manifold. But so it's something very special. And the philosophy is very different, of course, from those in string theory and so on and so forth, where you want to have higher dimensions and you hope to do things with the higher dimensions. Whereas here, you're taking the dimensions that you've got and you want things to come out from a different direction, not from higher dimensions. But yes, I mean, that's... Yes?
There's a natural suggestion that some people have heard, I wonder if you've thought about it, that a way to go to higher dimensions would be to go from the Riemann sphere to the analog for quaternions to go up to six dimensions. So you've got the four-dimensional space the light cone in six dimensions, or the Apollonian sphere to go to 10 dimensions.
Yes, I would be very doubtful that gives us something useful. The main reason is that with complex numbers, you have a nice function theory. And you get tremendous richness from the holomorphic function theory structure. If you talk about quaternions, then it kind of gets very stuck. I don't know of a good function theory in quaternions. Not just that I don't know it, I mean, you can see that there isn't one in a certain sense. Because you can write down the complex conjugate of a quaternion in a form which looks as though it's an analytic expression. So it doesn't lend itself to the kind of thing that one does in twister theory. I mean, sure, that's a thing you can do, and there are higher versions of twister theory which do just that. But they don't seem to have the kind of richness that one's looking for here. it's very tied to the space-time dimensionality that we see directly. So that the philosophy is very different from much of current theory. But that's the way it's gone, and that's the way I'm going. So, if it, yes.
Can you understand this transform from tweaked space questions and tweaked space questions and space time? A circuit Fourier transform.
It's a bit like a it has something in common with Fourier transforms. Yes, it's better if I just go to the bottom of this transparency, because it's the point about it. What it really is it's it's a bit more like a radon transform, but it's a transform to cohomology. That's the crucial thing, because these functions, the twister function here, has singularities. You never get a non-zero answer for your contour integral otherwise. In any case, the homogeneity degrees force you into singularities very quickly. But that's not, you see, you don't think of these things as functions. You think of these things as things define all overlaps between open sets. So what you would do is...
Is it the group Fourier transform? Because the real group is S of 4Q.
It's not a Fourier transform in the ordinary set. Well, it's a cohomological thing. I mean, it's the same general family of transforms in the sense that it's a transform, yes. But it's not a Fourier transform. Yes. Yes.
Yeah. You can do it using group theory. Somewhere you can realize representations.
Yeah.
Solutions to.
Well, it certainly is related to group theory things, and there is a big theory which includes all this, which implies to other groups, bigger groups, and so on and so forth.
Is it a particular case?
Yes. Yes, it's a particular case of a general type of prescription of that nature, yes. But there are sort of special features which occur here, which one makes use of a lot. And one of these special features is that the cohomology one's talking about is first cohomology. That means that you cover your space in some way. Well, I've sort of indicated it here. The region of, there's some region of space-time you're interested in. You then, that corresponds to some region of twister space you're interested in. It tends to be the top half. The reason for that has to do with positive frequency. Remember this earlier transparency here, where the twister space is divided into two halves. And the top half has to do with positive frequency and the bottom half with negative frequency. It's like the Riemann sphere cut into two, and half the functions go one way and the other half the other way, giving you a splitting into positive and negative frequencies. So this aspect of quantum theory, quantum field theory, is very much taken over into the twister scheme. But what it means here is that you're looking at the top half of twister space, say, if you're looking at a wave function, you cover it with a lot of open sets, maybe two, you might get away with two, which is what I've basically done here, two open sets. On the overlap between those two open sets is where the twister function is defined. It's not a thing on the whole space, it's a sort of transition function thing. And this is important because when you generalize to curved space or to nonlinear interactions, Yang-Mills fields and things, this becomes an actual building of a bundle or building of a manifold. So that it's important that it's first cohomology. So when people ask me about higher dimensional twister theory and so on and so forth, you do get such theories, but the cohomology goes up. For example, if you looked at six dimensions, I'd have to think about which it is exactly, but you find that you're looking at second cohomology and so on. You have twisters, you can have higher dimensional twister spaces, but the specific dimension and the fact that you get first cohomology here is very crucially related to the space-time structure being four-dimensional, so that it's all kind of knits together in that way. If we talk about other dimensional space-times, it's one of the reasons I feel uncomfortable with the higher-dimensional schemes, because I can't fit these ideas into them. I'm not saying that it can't be done, because maybe there are other ways of looking at this, but I don't see how to do it. Now, one's particularly interested in gravity here, because that's what I want to be talking about. And the linearized gravity, I've just represented the curvature in terms of two spinners. One has an unprimed spinner representing the anti-self-dual part, and a primed one representing the self-dual part, these being totally symmetrical objects. The Bianchi identities in the linearized case become the same equations that we had before. and you can represent these things by twisted contour integrals just as before. The two homogeneity degrees being plus 2 for the anti-self dual part or the left-handed graviton, minus 6 for the right-handed graviton.
Is it the case that the homogeneity degrees always have the minus 4?
Yes. Yes. Well, that's the 2 in the in the formula. When I go back to the yes. Oh, sure. That's just this expression. See, that's the minus 2 there, and you've got 1 and you've got the other one. You add them up, you get minus 4. These two cancel out because you're looking at opposite helicities. Yes, sure, absolutely. So, but anyway, at first it might not worry you so much. Okay, two numbers and one's positive and another's negative. But when you start to look at nonlinear things, you find these different homogeneity degrees play crucially different roles. And now I want to describe, I'm afraid it's still old history, but at least it's nonlinear. General relativity. Well, there are numerous applications of twisters, which I don't want to go into. I'm talking about the general program here. And in, I think, 1976, I produced a construction for anti-self-dual or left-handed gravitons, what I call nonlinear gravitons. Because these are solutions of the Einstein equations, which are complex, but which satisfy the Einstein equations exactly, the vacuum equations, and they're anti-self-dual. So I regard these as nonlinear left-handed gravitons. And you can obtain these things from a twister construction by deforming twister space. Remember, twister space for flat space-time was a complex projective three-space, and what you're going to try and do is deform that. Well, there's a theorem which tells you you can't deform the whole thing, which is just as well for reasons, and you can see why it would lead to a contradiction. But what you can do is deform the tubular neighborhood of a line. Why are you doing that? Well, see, this line in the flat case represented a point in space-time, and what one's looking at, up there, the line represents a point in space-time, so you're looking at a neighborhood of a point here, so just looking at local geometry for the moment, some neighborhood of a point, finite neighborhood, that will correspond over here. As you let the point wiggle around in that neighborhood, this line wiggles around and sweeps out a tubular neighborhood. So to look at a curved little piece of the space-time here, I would try and deform that tubular neighborhood of a line. And indeed, you can do that. Basically, what I've indicated here is breaking it in two along the line, sliding one piece across relative to the other one, pasting them back down again, everything being holomorphic. You've got to make sure these are complex analytic functions that are used in this gluing. And now this line, which now has broken, you have to find another one which isn't broken, in other words, a holomorphic curve which belongs to the same topological class as the one you started with. It has to be a two-sphere, it has to be a holomorphic Riemann sphere. There are other ones which wind round more than once. You look at one which is actually belongs to the same topological class as that one. And what you find by theorems due to Kodaira and company, that as long as this deformation is not too outrageous, you will find a four-parameter family of these curves, a complex four-parameter family. And that's a rather remarkable fact, that just the condition that it belongs to the right topological class and is a closed thing, is a compact holomorphic curve, means that the space that represents these things over here is a four-dimensional space. You can also say what you mean by these things being null separated. That's just going back to what one said earlier of space-time, that these are null separated if these lines meet. That's a consequence of the flat twister theory, and I just say the same thing here. And then you find, rather surprisingly, first of all, that you get the space here has a natural conformal structure which is quadratic, and that you can then work out the Weyl curvature, which is conformally invariant, and you find the Weyl curvature is anti-self-dual, and this construction is reversible. If you start with an anti-self-dual Weyl curvature space, at least a small enough neighborhood, you might have global problems if you went too far away. You can reverse this construction and you find a curved twister space. Now, there are no Einstein field equations in that, But the Einstein field equations can be imposed very easily in the presence of the Weyl curvature being anti-self-dual. And in twister space, it just comes out as this, that you have a projection of your twister space down to a complex projective line. There's a slight extra things you need to say, but this is basically it. And this gives you a Ricci flat complex space-time, which is anti-self-dual. In fact, the general one. So this, you can actually construct the twister space constructively, and this gives you the general solution of the anti-self-dual Ricci flat anti-self-dual Einstein equations. The twister construction of the twister space is constructive. What's not so constructive is actually finding these holomorphic curves. So when you found the twister space, that's the easy part. The hard part is to find where these curves are, and that's not necessarily an easy thing to do. But in twister theory, you don't care about that. You're going to work with a twister space anyway, so you don't necessarily need it to be easy to find the space-time from it.
Okay, so you began here, of course, with McCarthy space.
Yes.
You know, the global projective twister space there.
Yes.
And then you looked at this jubilant neighborhood.
Yes.
So from the point of view of space-time, you obtain a solution that's in the neighborhood at this point?
I would do, yes, but since this is analytic, you can, it's an analytic continuation. It's got the whole, it's got all the information there.
So
you're certainly not. The only reason I'm doing it locally is you might run into non-Hausdorff problems.
But is that the only problem?
Yes. Yes, I think so.
The manifold, the metric might be non-Hausdorff, otherwise one would be going
to get it. Well, it's really the other way around I was worrying about. It might be, the metric might be non-Hausdorff, but I suppose I was thinking of your question the other way around. That's to say, if you had a space here which was anti-self-dual and you tried to construct the twister space for it, you might find the twister space ended up as non-Hausdorff. And you certainly do get things like that, but non-Hausdorffness is not regarded as a bad thing in this subject, provided it's mild. In fact, it's a very useful thing, you find. You can have things which branch and so on, that sort of thing. I have at the back of my mind that maybe that's a good thing for state reduction, see, because you have things evolving and then it does one thing or the other. But that's just a romantic thought. I don't have any I don't have any direct association with that. Yes?
Is there, I'm forgetting, is there a reality condition so you can look at, say, I mean, you wouldn't get a Lorentzian.
Yes, you're not likely to satisfy it here, that's the trouble, yes.
Yeah.
Because these, the...
get some Euclidean, perhaps.
Yes. In fact, there is a whole body of theorists and people on the other side of the corridor from where I used to be in Mass Institute, and people who are interested in geometrical questions, and they're usually interested then in positive definite spaces, and then yes, you can have anti-self-dual or self-dual, and that's just a condition on that space.
Do people know enough about those deformations to do math with?
Oh yeah, sure. And there's a whole subject. Well, Atiyah and Hitchin and Singer wrote a paper where they did my construction over again in the positive definite case, and they look at it a different way in some sense. You look at the twister space is a sort of bundle over the space, over the space-time, and the holomorphic conditions come out as integrability conditions on the almost complex structures and things. But it's the same thing, but written in a different signature. So there's a different flavour to the subject when you do it there. But yeah, it does carry over.
Okay, the reality condition here is...
Yeah, then the reality condition you can impose on how you... Yes, a sort of hermeticity condition on this. And there are these... things that they Kähler manifolds, and the way people treat hyper Kähler manifolds and things. It's a big subject.
Do the solutions have singularity?
Quite likely, yes. Yes.
So I mean,
sorry?
How does it square with the analysis?
Yeah. It's just like a pole in a central singularity in a holomorphic function. Oh, yeah.
Let's continue. Is there any control on what deformations you will have to do in order to get.
Well, certainly there are constructions for global ones. I mean, they're more like sort of particular examples that people have found. And people like Nigel Hitchin have certainly played with these things. And there are things like the Yao... it might relate to things in string theory because you have these complex manifolds that come up. And again, many of these things have twister-related constructions for them. So the ones looking at the... well, what was it? It was the...
Roger,
yes.
To relate to that, I mean, the deformation you're doing is just a deformation of the complex structure of the matter.
Yes, that's right. Yeah. I mean, I'm doing it, you can do it two ways. You can either take the J, which defines a complex structure in here, and deform that, or you can do it in the Czech way, which is what I just like better because it's, I can see it, what's happening better. But they're equivalent. You can do the sort of Dolbo type approach where you vary your complex structure, and then, yeah, you just go through that.
This is not my fact, you have sort of like an interdimensional space.
Yes, that's correct.
You can characterize, when you say you get the general self-dimensional solution,
it's an infinite dimensional space. Yes.
How many there are.
Yeah, so it's an infinite, as you say, an infinite dimensional space. But you'd expect that, because you're talking about solutions of the Einstein equations on some region which has no compactness specified on it. Yes, sir.
Better than that, I mean, yeah. There's a relation between, there's a generating function, so to say. So you could really start with the linear Einstein dual, and then Roger would give you
one parameter capacity. Yeah, I'll just give you that if you like it. Yes.
So in that sense, in general.
Yes, yes, you can take a linearized one and exponentiate it. Yes. Well, this is. Well, I mean, it comes back to. Just go back to the picture I had here, you see, that where you have a lot of open sets overlapping. These are just painted on the space here when you do the contour integral. But you think of them, I mean, the way I like to think of it is the paint dries, you see, and it deforms the things a bit. That really what it's doing is the paint is doing something active. And it's and what it does is it tells you how you're gluing these things together, or it slides one over the other. And that's really the way I'm thinking of it. So, well, I don't know. I can show you that one, if you like, or another one which is more or less saying the same thing. This is just showing you where the, if you start from the anti-self-dual Ricci flat case, then you have parallelism for the pi spinners, which is why it all works out so neatly. And you have these different parts of the curvature disappearing, different parts of this commutator on the pi. And that integrability condition on the pi is really what you're telling about this projection. In fact, I said there was a projection down to the pi space, and that translates into that geometrical construction. I think probably it's better if I show you the other transparency, which is saying you know the same thing here. I'll come to that bottom in a minute. You see, there is, as Abhay was just indicating, there is a relation to the linearized theory where you had these twister functions homogeneous of degree plus 2. Here is the twister space, and on that overlap between this region and this region, you paint your twister function of degree plus 2. But then you let the paint dry, and it sort of distorts things. And the way we think of that is that homogeneity degree 2 function is interpreted as an infinitesimal shunt between one and the other. So here we have, this is just an infinitesimal deformation of the complex manifold, but the deformation is achieved in the way I've written it down here. This is really a vector field on the space. And as Abhay was saying, you can imagine integrating that vector field, exponentiating that vector field to give you a finite deformation, which gives you a finite, a genuinely non-linear solution of the Einstein equations in the anti-self-dual case. This is the vector field here, I should say, right there. And notice that F, there are two derivatives in that, and if we start with homogeneity degree 2, then having two derivatives, it brings you down to something of zero homogeneity, and it's an appropriate thing to somehow the homogeneity is balanced. And so the plus 2, you can see the particular role that plus 2 is playing. And you can use the same function that you had here, do the contour integral, work out the psi, and indeed that is the correct linearized gravitational field corresponding to the infinitesimal deformation that you have here. So that all ties together very nicely, and that's in a certain sense half of the Einstein equations. Not a very good sense, I would say, because it's probably you have to exponentiate the space. The point is to try and find the other half, a geometrical construction for the other half, and to put the two together so that you will have a vacuum solution which incorporates both the right-handed and left-handed parts of the graviton. But notice, you see, we've got to incorporate a minus 6 degree function. And it's one of these irritating problems that has been around for over 20 years. I've lost track of how many years it is, maybe 25 by now. Perhaps not quite, over 20 years. Yes. It's taken 20 years, and I feel now that we're making some progress. And the problem really is to see how to find a role for the minus six functions as a deformation of the space. Well, the way in which it's going to work is that we somehow split it into the right and left-handed parts, and I'll show you how we can do that. And the left-handed part is just the same as it was before. So we have a projective three-dimensional twister space that is essentially the same construction that I was just talking about when I was making these deformations of spaces and so on. I just do the same thing as before. And then the rest of the information is contained in how the non-projective space sits over the projective space. And the minus six functions are encoded in some kind of distortion of this bundle.
The normally graviton, you needed the whole twister space, didn't you? Or was it just the projective twister space?
You.
I thought there was a scale factor.
The way it's actually done is to use the whole thing.
Yeah.
It depends on who you are, because of course, people on the pure mathematics side like to talk about some bundles. They tend to talk about things done on the projective space, but it's the same thing. Yes, you're right. In fact, to be a little bit more precise, let me put another transparency up here. Because this is... basically, you use these forms. In fact, they're going to be important to what I want to say. Basically, what one is looking at is a one form and a three form. This is the same thing I've been talking about before. Well, let me give you this transparency. I've got loads of transparencies. I wasn't quite sure what order to present them to you in. But this is, first of all, flat space. And that's these equations here. And there are forms which come out naturally in flat space. And in particular, when you do the contour integral, I think I wrote pi d pi somewhere in my expression. And that was that pi d pi. I have all sorts of different ways of writing that. That just means pi contracted with d pi, which is... the thing I've written at the top here, this is the infinity twister, which is another way of writing things, but it's basically that expression there, that's pi d pi. But that is the form iota. So iota is the expression that comes into the contour integrals in the way one normally writes it. Sometimes one writes this not in the homogeneous form, but in inhomogeneous form as a non-projective twister space, and there are advantages in doing that. And then you take the d of that, which is a d pi, this thing here. So the thing tor is half the exterior derivative of iota. And I use the particular Greek letters that are indicated here because they're supposed to have a mnemonic nature, otherwise I'd never remember them. So tor is a two form, theta is a three form, and phi is a four form. Iota, well, I tried to think of something else for one form, but it seemed to me iota will do. I can't use omega because I've already used that for the twister, the spin apart, you see, so that's... Maybe if I started all over again I could, but that would confuse me. I don't want to confuse myself anymore. These are the various forms... Okay, there's a natural three form. Well, the four form is really the volume form on the twister space, and the three form is the natural volume form on the projective space, which is a weighted thing, but it's this thing here. Those are the various forms. And the four form is a quarter of the exterior derivative of the three form. Now, these all exist in flat space, but in answer to your question, yes, in the standard construction, you take those over into the non-projective, non-linear graviton pore space. And it's easiest to talk about the construction and where the metric comes from and so on in terms of that. So I agree, that's what you would do normally. But I suppose, really, the answer to your question is that in the standard nonlinear graviton construction, you do use this space here, but the bundle is sort of trivial. There's no information in it. It's just a natural bundle that you can grow out of that one if you want to. So there's no extra information in there.
Yes. Now we have the Tedros transform which gives us the subdual solutions, and now you want to get anti-subdual ones. But are you now sort of starting with a deformed Q-space and trying to do something on it, or are we back to the current state?
I'll come to a little bit more exactly what I'll do in just a second, I think. I was only just trying to define the forms for the moment, but I'll tell you what it is. I think just to get... this can be flat space, or it can be the old nonlinear graviton, which I'll call the leg break graviton. Cricketers will understand why, because the googly is the other, is the right-handed one, and the leg break is the left-handed one. Don't you worry me about the notation if you don't know anything about cricket. I don't know much about it, honestly. But this is the leg break construction. It's the old-fashioned one, 20 years ago, or flat space. Flat space, I would have these explicit expressions, or I could even use those in local coordinate neighborhoods. But they're always related by these differential relations there. And I want to indicate particularly the Euler vector field, which is this homogeneity function, which came in as defining the helicities and so on, can be thought of as simply the four form divided by the three form. What I mean by that is that if you have a function, A, then D of A wedge the three form is equal to the Euler vector field acting on A times the four form. So if you like, that's what eta is, this divided by this, so to speak. The three form, of course, gives you a direction field on a four space, but you want to scale it back, so it's actually a vector field, not a density, and that's what I've done here. There are these relations here which satisfy, that is the one form and the two form wedged together are zero, which is just the Hooge-Flip relationship. I knew I'd forget it at the critical moment. Which tells you that the one form things knit together to form three surfaces. Thingamajig relation. Yes. Frobenius, that's the fellow. That's what I want. Yes. Yes, that iota wedge d iota is zero. That's Frobenius. Yep. And so that's this thing here. But then iota also wedging theta is zero. I could give you the geometrical meaning of that in a minute, but let's not worry too much for the moment. I'll come back to the bottom of that stuff in a moment. But just to answer Abhay's question, what am I talking about? Well, the way to think about what I'm talking about most precisely is to think of a rather specific type of space-time, and how one would generalize this to a general space-time would need thinking about. But let's talk about a space-time which is asymptotically flat, in the strong sense that it even has a good I plus. So whereas in this picture I've indicated with a lot of spots there that there might be a source somewhere in the middle, maybe there are black holes hanging around in the middle or something, I don't want to consider those for the moment. I mean, sure, I'll want to consider those eventually, but just to keep life as simple as I can, let's consider a space-time which radiates away and has a good point at the top here. So this is... fortunately, we know things exist like that because of the work of Helmut Friedrich. So at least it's not a vacuous subject I'm addressing here. Moreover, these things can be analytic. They better be, for at least what I'm going to start with by saying. And one again would want to get rid of that condition, presumably too. There are all sorts of things that one would like to improve on this, ways in which one could improve on this, perhaps. But for the moment, let's say analytic, asymptotically flat. So you've got a good outside plus. And also a good point at the top, I plus. So it's just waves floating away, disappearing and leaving nothing. I might even say Brill wave, I suppose, mightn't I? But that's the kind of thing we're talking about here. Now, analytics, so you can complexify. Of course, on Scry, one could have a retarded parameter U and an angular complex parameter going around there, a stereographic parameter. When you complexify, U becomes complex and zeta becomes separated from its complex conjugate, so I call that zeta tilde. You have these three coordinates and I write them as a box like that just to make life easier to visualize. This is a complexification of Scry. I should say that there are likely to be holes in the space too. If you wander too far away from the real slice, you're going to have singularities. So there will be a kind of diagonal of this, and you're really talking about the neighborhood of that. I won't worry too much about that for the moment, although it plays important roles in what you can do and what you can't do. Now, the sort of origin of all this is Ted's H-space, and I'll relate it to Ted's H-space in just a minute. But how we can define in such a situation, even without I plus being a well-defined point, you could have a hole up there too if you want. So far, that was perfectly all right. You can define your twister space as the space of twister lines, or alpha lines, I might call them. Let's say twister lines. Those are curves on complexified scry, which would have been the intersections with alpha planes. And remember, an alpha plane in flat space represented a point in projective twister space. So this is doing the best you can. You may not have alpha planes because the space may have conformal curvature, but nevertheless you can ask the question, where would this line be if there were alpha planes? Can you write down an equation for this line which would follow were it the intersection with an alpha plane, and does that equation still work in the general case? The answer is yes. In fact, in this case it's just a null geodesic. What you find is that the null geodesics on complexified scry are of three kinds: either generators, which are these purple ones going up like that. I'm sorry, Ted, the colors are probably going to... You know all this stuff anyway, so you don't mind. Yes. These vertical ones are the generators, the ones which lie in beta planes on scry. Scry actually has complete beta planes and has alpha planes too. Well, complete is a bad word here. It has beta planes and alpha planes on it. And on the beta planes, the null geodesics rely on them are twister lines. The null geodesics which rely on the alpha planes are dual twister lines. And you can then construct, this is a it's a three-parameter family of these things. So you construct a complex manifold. That complex manifold is a twister space, a projective twister space. Now, I should tell you what this has got to do with Ted's H-space by putting H-space up here. You see, Ted's way of looking at this was to think, starting off with complexified scry and looking for cuts, cross-sections, local, near the reals, but not actually real, which were given by the vanishing of the shear of the null surface which would intersect this locally at infinity. I never can remember whether it's with a bar. Anyway, I think this was H-space, yes. Yes, that's right, I've even got it on the transparencies just to remind myself. If sigma equals naught, then this indeed is what Ted defined as H-space. However, for twister theory, I would have preferred him to have done it the other way around, or he would have preferred me to do mine the other way around. That is the H-star space, where you take the complex conjugate of sigma to be zero. You see, it's always confusing. Sigma is a complex quantity, so when you complexify, it gets separated from its complex conjugate. And sigma then is still a holomorphic thing. Its complex conjugate is another holomorphic thing, but it's not the complex conjugate of sigma anymore. It only was on the real slice. It's wandering off to something else, and we call that sigma tilde. So don't worry about that distinction. It's only just a question of getting the signs of handedness right and so on. But these cuts, which are global, appropriately global, give you the points in H-space. Now, what's the relationship between H-space and this twister construction? Well, what it turns out to be, as you take the twister lines, as I just defined them, and these are represented by points in the projective twister space, if you have a good cut, that means you have a family of these twister lines, which in this space here gives you a compact curve, which is a Riemann sphere. So you have a compact curve, a Riemann sphere. And remember, the twister construction for points in the space-timing quotes coming from this space was to take these holomorphic curves. They are cross-sections of this projection. That's another way of thinking of it. So you have the projection down to the pi space, you lift them back up here, and those curves are the points in H space, in fact. And if you translate that over here, see, as you move that point along here, because you're a family of these twister lines, you have the cut ruled by twister lines. That is just Ted's construction, rephrased a little differently, that's all. And I think at the bottom I've just said a twister line, and also a dual twister line, and also a generator, they're all null GD6.
Is this connection between Ted's H-space and twister space lead to a corresponding connection between quantization that Ted is working on?
I should ask Ted.
No, I'm just doing this moment, just reformulating. I'm trying to do something very similar to what Roger's doing.
Yeah.
Reformulating.
That's right.
No, we had a paper together.
Oh, that's
it. Yeah. Okay. Explain that to me afterwards.
But in this picture, mm-hmm. you never really needed it, not in the past space time. You just say that somebody uses grad together with some function, which is a spin wave function, which is called sigma. Right?
Oh, yes, that's true. Yeah, yeah. So you're right. I mean, I could have done this without starting from this. But what I want to say in a minute. I need to do that. The main reason being that I don't otherwise have a splitting into positive and negative, in the right-handed and left-handed. See, the thing is that if I have a decent scry, then I have a natural splitting into the right and left-handed parts, because I can look at the on-scry, I can look at the, well, it's down here, I can look at the H-space, which is a complex space-time. Which, another way of thinking of it, would be to say, take your original space-time, supposing it has a good I plus now, and kill off all the self-dual radiation, just keep the anti-self-dual paths, just construct a new space-time, starting at the top, if you like, where you've killed off all the self-dual part and just kept the anti-self-dual part, and then reconstruct that and see what space would have given you that radiation field. And that's the H-space. So another way of thinking of H-space is, it's you start with an asymptotically flat space, try to extract from it the a sort of space-time, a complex space-time, which has the anti-self-dual radiation of the space, but where the self-dual part has been put to zero. And so that it gives you, if you like, a way of, when you start from a space-time which is neither anti-self-dual nor self-dual, gives you a way of picking, sort of splitting it into the two parts, which you might not naturally see how to do otherwise. So that's where this comes in.
There's yeah. nothing special about the self-dual or anti-self-dual space-time.
No, space-time, and that was the original idea. And the original space-time was not meant to be anti-self-dual or self-dual. It was just a radiating space-time. Yeah, you could take out half, that's right.
One might not have the motivation of one's mind, but that's
yes.
actual construction, either space or yours.
Yes,
it doesn't really
yes.
depend on having an internal space time, right? You just give
that's correct,
start.
Yes.
You give
yes.
yourself some initial value, quote unquote,
yes, sure, yeah.
And then you just complexify it and you obtain your space in the
yeah.
space.
No, I quite agree with you. But you see, the motivation, I'm going back, if you like, somewhat to the earlier motivation, is saying you're thinking of H space as something that you construct from a space time. You've got a space time. Okay, it doesn't give you back the space-time, it gives you something else, it gives you H-space. But my intention is to try and get space-time back. And that's so it's going back to the original ideas a little bit more. But, yeah. Okay. Now, the twister space I've got here has simply forgotten, from what I've just been saying, it's forgotten the self-dual information. It's only got the anti-self-dual information. And what I want to try and do is to get it back. And the way to get it back is as follows. A way, and I think it's the way. This is how to encode the googly as well as the self-dual information. Now, let me just, first of all, in a sense, going back to Jim's comment, you can produce the non-projective space-time. See, this only gives you the projective space-time because I've got the twister lines. But if I say that my pi spinner is to be parallelly propagated along, this equation here is telling us, see, this is just the spin connection in the, this is very similar to what our pi does. And
yeah,
the same sort of.
Derivative operator on the car.
Yes.
It is a pullback of the space-time derivative operator, and you can split it into
yes.
One kind of spinner from one of the other kind of
spinners. Yes, that's right.
It corresponds to one.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's right, yes. I mean, I'm sure it relates to a lot of things that you do and so on. But let me just continue with this. You can say that the pi, this is proportional to that, is to say that this is it's a twister line. That really is the equation for a twister line. It happens also to be the equation for a geodesic, because if I made this into a vector by putting an iota. The iota points up the generators. If I took an iota and multiplied it by the pi, because the iotas are actually propagated also, this equation tells you this is a geodesic. So it is a geodesic on Scribe. Now, what one normally did, what I would have done up to about a year ago, was to put zero on the right-hand side of this equation. Say that the natural thing to do is to propagate the spinner so that this is naught here. And that gives you a scaling. I can start with a pi, which is a small or a big one, and so on. And those different scalings give us the non-projective twister space. The non-projective twister space can also be found, very naturally, by putting naught here. And that gives us the space that we had before, the leg break space, and the thing that Jim would be happy with, because you can then talk about the construction using the inhomogeneous, using the non-projective space, which in fact is what made me happy too. So But now, what we do is the following. We take this crazy looking equation here. It may look a little crazy, but it's in fact, there's very little you can do which is invariant in all the ways that are required. This psi is the, well, you see, to make it make sense on Scry, you have to do the scaling. This is the self-dual vial curvature written in spinner form, and then this is the self-dual vial curvature written in spinner form, and then you define this object by taking the conformal factor. You need a conformal factor, of course, to make Scry finite and so on. You take a suitable conformal factor to make Scry finite, and the vial curvature goes to zero, but if you take omega to the minus 1 times it, you get something finite, and the reason for taking omega to the minus 1 times it is that this entity now satisfies the massless field equations in vacuum. So that's conformally invariant. This is the way that the massless field equations would transform to preserve the... I don't know if I said that very well. The way I like to think of it is that the big capital psi, this thing here, is actually the vial curvature, or the self-dual part of our curvature. The little psi here is a massless spin 2 field, which happens to equal the vial curvature when you choose the omega being 1. But if you choose a general conformal factor, they just scale away from each other. But this one satisfies the massless field equations. This one doesn't. But that's a useful philosophy to have when you're talking about Scry and so on, because this is the thing that remains finite on Scry, as it should, because Scry is a conformally, you don't care. I mean, massless field equations don't particularly care where Scry is. They just go shooting through it. And that was one of the initial reasons for thinking that Scry was a good idea. But anyway, here we have the scaling. So, okay, this is basically the component of the vial curvature in the direction of the generators, but you have to bring the scaling in because the vial curvature actually is zero. Okay. And this is the derivative in that direction, and then to make everything balanced, I put the pi 1 to the minus 5 there. So you count the number of 1 primes. You see, you've got 4 of them there, 5 of them there. You've got to balance them all off. So there's no choice about that if you want it to be scale invariant. Well, I played around with all sorts of things you could might try here, not this one first, but nothing else worked.
Did you coordinate with the second time derivative this year?
Yes, this is already the second derivative. It's already the how many? First derivative. Ted, help. This is the first. This is the second derivative of the ship.
No,
psi
four.
That's the psi four.
It's going to be the second derivative.
Second derivative of the ship. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Second derivative of the ship. Yes. Yes. Third derivative of a metric thing. I'll tell you why. It's actually not an unnatural thing, in a minute. But just that's just the definition for the moment. And I said that I did try all sorts of different things, and the only thing which balanced was this, which gave you everything you need to balance all sorts of things, and that's that. So although it looks a little funny, it is in fact really quite a natural thing. Pi 1 is just this component here, and all these things I think are self-explanatory. Sorry?
Sherlock Holmes principle.
You could say it's a Sherlock Holmes principle. Well, it might be, but it does tie in with other things, you see. That was the thing about it. Yeah, I should make this comment. Or should I make another one first?
This is another thing at 2 o'clock. So
oh. What's the time? I've got my watch and I've hidden it under my transparency.
1:30.
Oh, I see. Okay, yeah. Right. So we'll try and tidy things up by then. Solve the Einstein equations in complete generality and that sort of thing. Yes. I don't know. Well, let me tell you something else first. So I'll come back to that one. What is actually a useful thing to think of is not simply to do this at Scry, as I've done here, but to do it also on a finite light cone. In fact, most of the things I'm saying will work just as well on the finite light cone, with certain slight differences. This is the finite light cone, complexified, so it's analytic and all that. Now I have microns instead of iotas, this is notation, pointing up the generators. The equation I had before is now to be replaced by this one, where this is the same old psi that we had, the Masters-Fieldston 2, helicity 2. This object here is the conformally invariant Thorn operator, which is to be found in Spinners in Space-Time, Volume 1, which is used in connection with the initial value problem. So if you were thinking about flat space, and you had some cone, or it needn't be a cone, that would be maybe not a clean vertex, and you want to specify data on this cone for a massless field of helicity 2, the null data, which is the thing which you, when you go inside and you want to integrate it out, you find this is the quantity. Perhaps I should show you that transparency here. That's this one. Yes, that's the definition of the Thorn, conformally invariant Thorn, using spin coefficients and so on. Ted will tell you what all those mean if you've forgotten. And this is what you find in the generalized Kirchhoff-Dadhimar formula for a massless field. It doesn't have to be a spin 2, it can be any spin. On the cone, which needn't actually be a cone, it can have a messy looking excuse for a vertex down there. And then the quantity that you integrate is simply the same quantity that I'm talking about. So it's in some sense a natural object to be talking about. Now, for what I do is I take this out to Scry, you see, what I just did before. But this is just to explain that it is quite a natural looking object.
What are you going to do with that equation? We will accept that you want that equation. What are you doing for that?
Well, what I do is I've done it actually. Yes. What I do is what I did. But I haven't said it, that's my problem. Yes. You take the solutions of that equation rather than the solutions of this with a zero. And those are the points of my twister space. So that's given us the space here. The different points, you see, if I start off my equation, maybe I take a starting value for pi and propagate it by this equation. Then the different, I can do this in different ways. Start off, propagate, start off, and propagate. And each of the solutions of that equation is a point on a fiber. So It doesn't look as though I've done much, if you like, but I have. Each point on the fibre here, which is the non-projective twister corresponding to that projective twister, is a solution of that equation. And I can scale it up and down by choosing different starting values. Pi, notice, grossly inhomogeneous in pi, and that's really why it's doing something. Sorry, Lee.
So you, for each starting pi on scry or on the null point at that point, you make a one-parameter family of pi, and that's how you do it.
Well, no, it's not. You see, you don't really have a natural starting point, which is why it's doing something in a sense. Because...
But is it a one-parameter family when you say you're propagating it?
I can do it on scry, or I can do it on a finite cone. Finite cone is a little easier to think about, but it's a little more complicated because you have to bring the thorn in and so on. But the equation's all right. So it's just a solution of the equation.
On the cone.
On the cone. Yes. On the cone. Yeah. Yeah. It's not actually. Yes. That's a point I should just make here. On the light cone, it's not always a null geodesic, usually not. It depends on the shear of the cone. If the cone is non-shearing, it will be a null geodesic. Sorry?
It would have been a null geodesic.
That's right, because scry doesn't shear.
So why don't we just look at scry?
Well, I'm going to have to look at both, that's why. But I can look at scry first, yes. Sure. Well, that's just putting this transparency back.
And each such curve is a point in the non-geodesic.
Yes, yes, that's right. Now you might think it's not done anything because you could just take some starting point, but this is it's a cohomological thing. That's the important thing, is that there's no holomorphic way of taking a slice of this thing so that your starting points are kind of all uniform. You have to take one place to do your starting points and then somewhere else to do your starting points again, and you get a patching between the two, and that patching gives you the cohomology.
But
yes.
The key point is that the cohomology in the space of the solution captures the...
It captures the self-dual part of the radio. Yes, it does. Yes, it does. It's not so obvious. From what I said, it's not at all obvious. But it does. Yeah. And the reason it does, the easiest way to see it, it's not the way I realized it first.
So the parameterization is very important. It's not just the identity. Because I could have taken 0 that I can divide down
to. That's right. That's right.
What is it about the parameterization that is
in the
scope of
one itself?
How is the parameterization
system? Well, it's just giving us the points on the curves. I mean, I don't know how else to say it. But I have different solutions. And I mustn't take 0. That's not included. But anything else, I just propagate it according to that equation. And since I have one complex constant of integration, given the curve, I have one complex constant of integration. And that is the fiber over here.
So it's not just a geometrical geodesic there that corresponds something here, because it's parameterized.
Yeah, well, the geodesic is the point down there, you see. But the parameterizations, the different constants of integration in that equation, give us different points on the fiber. So it's that's what it's doing. Yeah, I mean, it takes a little bit to get one's mind around this thing, but that is what it's doing. In fact. Just a brief comment, although I think it probably would be a waste of time to go into it in detail. It is related to something that Mike Eastwood did. I didn't know this at the time, but Lionel Mason reminded me. Mike Eastwood's paper is very confusing because there's a serious misprint in it which threw me completely when I read it. But it's in the Further Advances in Twister Theory. And it's a way of representing massless fields in general with the primed index kind. So it's the positive velocity with the normal conventions. I don't think I'll go through this, but I just wanted to indicate that it is related to a fairly natural construction. That's, I think, all. If people want to know more about it, I could tell them, but it is related to a natural construction. It's not quite the same. It's kind of taking a small part of this construction, but it's a small part which contains all the information. Yes.
Just given the time constraint,
yes.
Is it possible to sort of jump ahead?
Well, I'll come back to this one.
Okay.
Yes. Yes. Well, I guess there are a couple of things I can jump to. One of them is this picture, and the other thing I should jump to is all this stuff. So I'm not sure which order to do it. Let's do this first. These are the forms. Now, In the standard nonlinear graviton, or the leg break thing, you have all these forms. That's what I was saying before. In this case, you still have them, but not completely. What you have is iota and phi up to proportionality in such a way that that they scale oppositely, so that the tensor product of iota and phi is an invariant object. There's also this relation. I mean, in fact, the forms all have homogeneity relations, which are telling you that they're lead derivative with respect to this finitely defined. So you don't actually now have the phi. It's given. You only have it up to scale, so that you don't actually have the Euler form. It gets messed up, and which relates partly to Jim's question about can you have fields of arbitrary spins on these things. But what happens is the helicity gets kind of messed up. It's not this the Euler operator. And now gets made. It's not even defined globally. It's you define it in local patches, and when you go from one patch to the next, it's not the same. But the homogeneity relations on the forms can be written in this funny-looking equation here, where this funny symbol here is something that all relativists can write down without any difficulty. But if you try to explain it to a pure mathematician, you have to go through some rigmarole, because basically what you're doing is you're taking the forms and skewing all the indices of one with one index of the other, and that's all it's doing. That's what this thing means. And this equation is the homogeneity equation. It expresses all of them, in fact. These ones are automatic, and these ones are expressed like this. So I have this relation, and I have this thing. I'm supposed to know that. What else am I looking for? Let me say the other thing then. Yeah, find my right transparencies. This is really getting to the point of what one does here. See, if you do this construction on Scry, I have a twister space. It's the twister space, I call it curly T plus. It's the twister space with respect to Scry plus. I could do it for a finite point, and I have another twister space relative to the point P. Now, if I take, let's assume everything is nice and P is close enough to I plus that I have a broad enough family of these things, and I look at twister lines which are close to generators, then if they're close to generators, they will get up and hit Scry. And then I can take the same pi, so I propagate the pi along here by the equation I just gave you. When I hit Scry, I then propagate it along Scry by the equation I gave you. So I have a natural way of identifying any twister line or any part of the, let's see, any twister which belongs to the twister space relative to P of some open set. That open set, probably I should have a do this on the board.
Getting a different twister space for each point.
Yes, I have a different twister space for each point, but in a certain sense they're all the same, and that's the slightly curious thing I want to try and get across.
Yes. It somehow seems that, I mean, supposing I just had two points, P and
yes.
Q,
yes.
And Q was in the causal feature of P, then what you have is a map from the twister space over P to the twister space over Q, and that's what expresses the geometry.
You could do that, but that's not what I'm doing unless one of them is at infinity. If one of them is not at infinity, I don't think it's what I want.
Okay.
But that's, yeah, I mean, I certainly was wondering about that. But if I'm allowing one of them to be at infinity, then I can identify an open set's worth, and what I should say, it's a kind of big open set, in a sense. It has a certain globality properties, a big open set of one space, that is the canonical one's infinity, with the one defined for P. This will apply for any p, so long as it's close enough to I plus, if you like. So probably I'm looking at a neighborhood of I plus, probably, when I do this. And it takes the scales over as well. So the whole twister space is identified. Now, looked at from the point of view of the twister space defined at Scry, what it looks like is that I drill a hole in it, and I don't have a picture which is doing what I'm trying to say here, so let me just draw it on the board. I have the twister space at infinity, which is one say here, which has certain global properties. I have another space corresponding to space-time, just a space, which has certain global properties. And I make an identification between these, which is of sort of the following place. I take a whole, I remove part of this space, and I look at some neighborhood of that, and identify that neighborhood with something corresponding down here. I've got a hole from here too. And identify across from one to the other. Yes, but I don't expect to do this globally. What I expect to do, I'm trying to find something more general than what we had before, which was that here's your twisted space, or projective one, and I've got lines in it representing points in space-time. Now, I'm not doing that here. I'm doing something a bit like thickening that out. I cut a hole here, take that hole out, which is what I'm doing here, and stick something else in it. So I'm calling that a surgery. So that the points in space-time are not identified with these holomorphic curves, but they're identified with certain surgeries. And it's what's going on in this picture. And
so we have to avoid this equation. Yes. Because the other one is another building.
Oh, it's another building. Well, that's more serious. Well, do I have to stop now, or do I have a few minutes? Okay. So let me. Perhaps I should end with this particular family of questions. I should say that the forms that one has here, they don't give you the Euler vector field, but you can see how to build your space up, patching together, preserving, I've lost the transparency, which says exactly what I was trying to say here. It preserves, something to say. It preserves this product, and I think it's another thing which you have to preserve as well. And the freedom in that is these minus six functions. The minus six function shows up in the Euler vector field. That when you patch from one patch to the next, the relationship between the Euler vector field in one patch and the next patch is given by a homogeneity degree minus six function. And it's a crazy looking thing, but it does correctly encode the information. But let me just put these basic questions here. First question is, how do you construct the twister space from this analytically thing? Well, I've told you that. That's this strange-looking construction. How do you reconstruct the space-time from T? Well, that's what I've been sort of hinting at with the surgery. The surgeries would have to have the property, and this is there's some conjectural, importantly conjectural aspect. That is, I don't know the answer, and they could turn out to be wrong. But the idea is that the family of these surgeries, if you specify it right, exactly what you want to do, should be a four-parameter family. It's like saying these holomorphic curves give you a four-parameter family. This is something much more nebulous, but nevertheless, it's pretty. I think I can see how to make it pretty well defined. This family of surgeries has to be a four-parameter family. And that each surgery corresponds to a point in the space-time. So that would be the idea of how you reconstruct the M. And as I say, there are conjectural, strongly conjectural aspects of this. And then you ask, why should the Einstein vacuum equations be implicit in this construction? And I think all I want to do here is to indicate a reason for why one should believe in three. I think the key is number two, actually. That's really, you want to make sure you get it tied down so that it's the right family of surgeries which correspond to the space-time points. But the reason for believing in maybe the third one there, oh dear, I thought I could flap this transparency up, and now I had it a minute ago, and it's floated down underneath this pile of things. I can show you the structure. I said there were certain things that's the one I was talking about before. The form that I just told you, that's one of them, has to be part of the structure. This form here is also part of the structure. And you need to specify that and that, and the freedom when you go from one patching to the next is given by minus six functions. The freedom on the fiber is given by minus six functions. So that's that. Yes, and here's the other thing I just want to say. Why do I believe the Einstein equations are likely to be true? And here this is just a program, I suppose, more than a proof of anything. Here is the I've just written here, this is the twister space here, and I take the product space of that with the different points. These are the different, each different surgery, you see, will give you a point up here. And then you form this differential form, and you find that at least it looks as though it's Sparling's three form, George Sparling's three form. And the Einstein vacuum equations are the condition that that three form is closed. And the way this is constructed, it comes out as sort of automatically closed. This is, but I think if we've got to stop, I should probably, can't say more about it. I mean, this is again conjectural, because mainly because one doesn't know this is a four-parameter family. But you have to make sure that the form, the interpretation of the forms is what it should be, and it really is Sparling's three form. But certainly, if you look at it in flat space, it certainly is. So the question is whether the deformations make it still the three form. But that's the way I would see the vacuum equations being encoded in the constructions that I've been given. Well, I think that's it.